Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Squat Cobbler. This is episode 58, take two. I'm Mike at Official Pagan on everything, and joining me, as always...
Hi, everybody. This is Kelly at K-E-L-L-Y-T-H-U-L on Twitter. And we had a super weird start to our podcast in that Mike did the intro, and I didn't hear a single word of it. There was just huge amounts of dead air. I'm like, anytime. But we're good now. Everything's well.
Excellent. Good. As long as you can hear me, then we're good. We're doing another one of our prisoner exchanges. For any of you who don't know, Kelly and I had such a good time doing the Alice Cooper reviews. We decided to keep the album review thing going. We're doing these album prisoner exchanges. It's an idea that Kelly came up with, where we're each exposing the other one at a time to an album that was influential on us in some way or that we have strong opinions about, and getting the other one's opinion on it. I decided, since we did a few, you know, sort of edgy, somewhat divisive albums, I would just take it easy this week, do something that couldn't possibly offend anybody, and that's Philosophem by Burzum. Do you have any top line reaction on this, Kelly?
So he wasn't officially a member of Up With People, correct? Just want to kind of clarify that. Top line reaction. So this has been discussed quite a bit post show that this was coming, and Mike's going to be providing some additional context on why there's some nuance to this album and artist. But I enjoyed it. As we get through and we talk about it, I'll cover there's a couple places I was thrown a little bit. But I did actually enjoy it quite a bit, particularly the front half of the album.
Interesting. Okay. So before we get too far into it, if anyone doesn't know who Burzum is, I don't recommend a Google search. It might give you some preconceived notions about what you're about to listen to. So here's the thing, especially in today's age with the Me Too movement and all that stuff, I think that more and more people are actively becoming aware of the sometimes troubling nature of the personal lives and opinions of the artists who create the things that we consume. So I remember being a kid, going to museums, falling in love with paintings, going home and looking up the artists in encyclopedias, kids who know what Wikipedia is now. Imagine Wikipedia was printed out and boring, although more accurate. That's what an encyclopedia was. Oftentimes, I would find that artists whose work I really enjoyed harbored beliefs or did things that I am very much not in line with. Has that ever happened to you, Kelly?
Yeah, a little bit. Occasionally you'll get to the soft white underbelly of a particular artist and you're like, I don't know so much anymore. So sometimes enjoy the art for the art's sake and don't dig too much into the artist's background, because many times it could be disturbing.
Yeah, and it's happened a lot with me. Authors is where it usually hits me the most. I'll get really into a particular author, read a lot of their books, and then find out that they're like Nazi sympathists or murder babies and like just absolutely insane things 7 books in or something along those lines. One of the things that's come up more recently, though, is how to put context to music artists who have, let's just say, like troubling backgrounds or difficult backgrounds to get around. I'm not talking about artists who in their music express extreme political views or social views or racist views or any of that kind of stuff. I'm talking about when their music doesn't necessarily reflect all of that, and then you delve into their personal lives and find out that that's what they as people are all about, even if it's not in their art. And I know for a lot of people it's incredibly difficult from that point forward to try and separate the art from the artist. And that's one of the things that I see that's happening a lot right now. So like, just as a good example, recently Spotify decided that they're going to remove a number of artists from their playlist that they generate themselves, because they feel like it's against, you know, the company policy to promote artists who do things that they don't agree with. And that's fine. And a lot of people applauded that. So an example of that, one of the artists who's getting a lot of attention right now that they pulled off of there is R. Kelly. Now, Kelly, I'm sure you're familiar with R. Kelly and why he might be a troubling artist to support.
I am familiar with the issues involved with Mr. Kelly.
Okay. So not a lot of people put up much of a fuss about that, but a few other groups have shot some emails or some public statements to Spotify listing more bands. Like, hey, if you're going to single out R. Kelly and this band, why not these bands? So I saw a article. I can't remember on which site it was. It was a bigger music site though. Either it was Vice or Billboard or something along those lines. That was like, hey, the problem with this whole thing, like, I get where everybody's coming from, but the real problem with all of this of singling out artists who you might want to be aware of their personal beliefs and values and maybe factor that in when you're making the decision to listen to them, is that we're ignoring huge, huge bands because of their popularity. So a good example of that might be, so let's just take R. Kelly, for example, who everything that's been said about him is essentially accusations. I'm not saying that he did or didn't do those things, but if you want to look at accusations against specific artists, Michael Jackson might pop to mind. But I don't really see a huge push to remove Michael Jackson from streaming services and playlists. Another even bigger example would be the Beatles. If we're going to talk about people's personal beliefs, I have a huge, huge problem with the personal lives of members of the Beatles. But I don't see anybody calling for a boycott of Beatles music. So with a band like Burzum, who is exceptionally difficult to separate the art from the artist, and I know I'm going on for a long time here, but I feel like this is all important to get out up front for the people who are familiar with Burzum and are going to have a preconceived notion about this. The band is led by its primary and only consistent member, Varg, who has extreme, in his personal life, extreme right-wing political views, and has gone to prison for murder and arson. These are things that I certainly would never condone. I don't want to speak for Kelly. He may be on the pro-murder and arson side. I don't want to make snap judgments, but I think he's probably not pro-murder and arson. That's safe?
That's a fairly safe assumption. And as we've talked on previous shows, we tend to try and go into the music, you know, independent of reviews of the album, independent of any kind of deep research. We kind of take in the Prisoner Exchange albums for what they are, and then kind of subsequent might do a little bit of digging to kind of be prepared to have the conversation we're having today, which was the path I followed for this. I had an inkling of some of the things I would find based on past conversations with Mike. And the whole murder stabbing part, as I read a little bit more about that, I know at
which
least
he contends is self-defense.
Yeah.
I feel like it should be said.
Yeah, which I found ironic because he, as he described the self-defense model, I was like, well, I went there, but this guy was set up with a taser and he was going to tase me and torture me to death. So I had to stab him 47 times, which oddly enough was the exact interaction Mike and I had in Atlanta at Snarkstock. I came and Mike had a taser and I was a little worried and I had brought the appropriate equipment to stab him 47 times, but it didn't work. You know, fortunately we were able to go to the puppet museum and everything worked out fine.
Puppets will do that. They'll defuse the situation so quickly.
Absolutely.
If only Varg and Euronymous had had puppets that night, things would be completely different.
It's a shame.
So I recommended this album for a number of reasons, though. I think it's topical to discuss an artist who has a troubled past, that's a situation where you should separate the artist from the art. Because, again, none of his personal beliefs bleed into his music. He's even gone as far as changing an album title shortly before the album's release because of preconceptions about the meaning of the album title. Because he strongly stands by keeping, you know, politics and religion, things like that, outside of his music. Obviously, his CDs, to the best of my knowledge, have never led to anyone's death. So there's no murder involved for the music itself. He's extremely, extremely influential. Burzum is an extremely influential band. And unfortunately, a lot of metal musicians, in an effort to distance themselves from his political views and to not want to sound like they're aligned with those views, which I completely understand, and I'm not aligned with those views in any way, try and pretend that Burzum doesn't exist, but borrow very, very heavily from him sonically. So, and I mean everything from like indie darling bands like Deaf Heavens to Metallica. In fact, Metallica's most recent album, I'm not even talking about their sonic influences from Burzum to Metallica, their most recent album, they actually have a music video. There is a biopic about Mayhem and Burzum coming out, which is going to be terrible, but there's a biopic coming out about the history between those two bands. Varg, as we were just discussing, murdered the guitarist from Mayhem during a time when he was serving as the bass player for Mayhem, and Burzum was on a record label that was run by the guitarist of Mayhem. It was a business dispute that ultimately led to the self-defense murder of 40-some-odd stab ones. Metallica had the cast of the biopic in full Mayhem and Burzum garb be their stand-ins for a recent music video off of their current album. So there's heavy, heavy influence from everything from, you know, underground metal bands to stadium bands like Metallica. So it's disingenuous, in my opinion, to pretend that this doesn't exist just because he has political views that most of us, I feel, don't agree with. We can't pretend that you're not borrowing from that music. And it's not that I'm supporting him or his beliefs, because I'm 100% against all of his beliefs in that area. But to me, it's interesting that we as a society are okay with the accusations against people like Michael Jackson, but not the accusations against R. Kelly. They were okay with the actions of certain members of the Beatles, but not okay with the actions of other people. I think we pick and choose things to be offended by. And I think in general, the best thing to do is to just separate the artist from the art. Because the reality of the situation, in my opinion, is that many artists whose work you consume in one fashion or another, you wouldn't agree with some of their personal beliefs if you knew them on a personal level. They're just smart enough not to espouse them on YouTube like some other people are. That's just my belief.
Yeah. And a condensed version of that might be, it's perfectly okay to like Cat Scratch Fever.
But not Girl Scout cookies.
Fair enough.
You got to get the deep cut Ted Nugent references in.
It's a staple of Squat Cobbler.
All right, so let's jump into this Prisoner Exchange review. I'm going to start off with the first track. Kind of reminds me of the Beach Boys a little bit now. The first track on the album is best known by the German language version of it, which is Dunkelheit, but it's actually the self-titled song, Burzum. If Burzum had a hit song, this would be the song. This is a really, really well-known song. It's appeared in a number of movies. The riff is really famous. You can find thousands of people on YouTube trying to play it. It's the closest thing to their mainstream commercial hit. Now, one of the things that you have to know about Burzum going into it is that they are considered to be one of the forebearers of the black metal genre. They were also one of the first ones to move away from it. So while their first couple of albums are basically strictly black metal albums, starting with the record before this, you start to get elements of ambient music, drone music, and then very quickly after this, they fall much more into ambient and folk music than metal altogether. But this song in particular is probably their best known song. It establishes a lot of Burzum's sound, which you can hear very, very, very heavily in a lot of the metal production of today, which is washed out, distant, tremolo-picked guitars. The, I would say, strangled vocal approach to the screaming, and the intentionally lo-fi production that a lot of bands nowadays, especially metal bands, are trying to emulate. One of the things they did with this record was they recorded things in a very limited number of takes on intentionally poor equipment. And he even asked for the worst possible microphone that he could record with, which was a headset like you would see on a 90s receptionist, just screaming into that instead of a actual microphone. What were your thoughts on this song, sir?
So while I respect the artistic integrity of I want to go lo-fi and I want to jack up the vocal lyrics, I wouldn't have minded a slightly cleaner version of the vocals coming through on that, and noticeable. And then I, as I mentioned to begin with, don't do any research before listening to it. Post listening to it, did some digging, and definitely found out about the commitment to lo-fi and the desire to say, get me the worst microphone possible. And whoever the sound person was very successful because
nailed it.
It is crappy. It's a driving song, dark ambient, kind of industrial flavoring to it. It's a good piece. It's a very good piece of music. It is what I kind of like too about it is it kind of comes out with that kind of driving industrial dark ambient sound to begin with. And then about halfway through, you get a slightly cleaner the motif of the song comes through again in a slightly cleaner fashion, as clean as it's going to get on this album. And it was a good interplay, but I thought this was a very impressive piece of music. I liked it quite a bit. And as I'm kind of settling in, because this is my first exposure to Burzum, I go, okay, I can get into this. I really enjoy this first song.
Now, I really had no... So for me, for anybody who doesn't know, professionally, the first music that I was involved in was black metal. So I had no idea what your exposure to black metal was. And of course, this Burzum is one of the founders of what we would think of today as traditional black metal. This is like the most extreme version of it that you're going to find. So I really didn't know what your reaction to it would be. But like I said, this is a especially popular song. So I felt like this, your response to this would be a good way to gauge where we're going to go from here. Plus two, you know, at just 7 minutes and 5 seconds, this is the shortest song on the album.
Yeah, it's a ditty. Although, I mean, most of the other ones weigh in a little bit more than this, with the exception of One Behemoth we'll talk about shortly.
All right. Well, moving right along, we have Jesus's Death. Hold on a second. I'm going to get my notes out. I actually took notes for this, which normally I don't do. But for this one, I wanted to get some notes just because I wasn't sure how the review was going to go. So what I like about this song, sticking with that kind of cold, distant guitar sound, the guitar notes on this almost sound brittle. Like the strings are about to break at any second. And one of the things, particularly on these early Burzum records, so these first few Burzum albums, which are considered like the classic albums, you know, recorded before he went to prison, these albums were actually all recorded in a short period of time and then released over a period of a few years. So a lot of it was recorded together. And it's interesting when you listen to them, because their sounds, there appears to be, when you listen to them, an evolution in the band's sound. But in reality, most of the songs in those first four albums were recorded in a short period of each other. So it's kind of an interesting thing. But one of the staples of these early albums is that the drums and bass are buried intentionally in the mixes of the songs. So in this song, the drums are like just a barely audible rumble in the background. And what did you think of this one?
So this reminded me a lot of Surfing USA. Actually, my first note on this was goth surf music, because I did this is actually my favorite track on the album.
Nice.
Because it is, you know, if the Beach Boys became possessed by the spirit of dark metal, this would likely be the kind of song they would do. And it has to be a very tiring song to play, because this clocks in over 8 minutes, I believe. And there's some serious repetitive guitarist stuff going on that has almost a, I had to throw in the Beach Boys reference just because Mike always does. But actually, it's probably a little more Dick Dale is where I would go in terms of not reminiscent, but if I was to draw any sort of parallel there. But I really enjoy this song. I agree the drums are kind of buried for the most part. They actually, but it kind of in my notes when I was talking about, boy, this guitar, it is kind of like goth surf music. And then towards the tail end of the songs, the drums actually do kind of pop up and they go, and in case you wondered what goth beach drums sounded like, it'd be this. And so it was pretty good there. I enjoyed the song quite a bit. It stays kind of in the same environment as the first song, and some different tonalities to it, but it fits really well. And so I'm two songs in, and I really enjoyed the first song, and like I said, this ended up being my favorite track on there. And lyrically, and I had to go to a site to pull the lyrics, because one could not decipher them. So evil that the flowers around withered could be a tagline for Squat Cobbler, good line for this. And I thought this was a really good piece of music. I enjoyed it.
Excellent. Well, that brings us to our third song, Beholding the Daughters of Firmament of the Firmament. This song is interesting because it's the only song, and again, these albums are recorded in close proximity and then released over a number of years. So by the time this track came out, in mainstream metal, there was a lot more groove-oriented metal that was going on. But in black metal, you never really heard that. And this song has a really distinct groove in the very beginning of it. That, again, in the late 90s, was very, very popular and directly led to the creation of nu metal, which you got in the late 90s and then heavy into the 2000s until, thankfully, it died off. But you could almost say that this is a precursor to that with the groove in the intro of the song. What were your thoughts?
So not a parallel entirely, but so when back in our Alice review days, a song near and dear to our heart was Sex, Death, and Money. And as this thing rolled out, I felt a little bit of a reminiscent of that. And I think it's pretty much it's the drums. Because I think probably if you looked at it, there's a pretty similar structure to what's going on there. But I just thought that was kind of an interesting kind of note on that. I like this song again quite a bit. The spirit of get me the worst microphone in the universe continues very strongly in the song. And it's a shame because, again, from a lyrical standpoint, in every night there's a different black is, you know, in the spirit of me having a completely tattooed body of lyrics at some point in time. Pretty good one. Good one in consideration from there. So it was kind of clever there. I enjoyed it quite a bit as well. And I thought it was kind of interesting that, like I said, it wasn't an exact parallel, but I did pick up a little bit of Sex, Death, and Money mojo in it as well at the beginning. So I like the song.
Very nice. Well, that brings us to the fourth song, Decrepitude 1, which, spoiler alert, there's a Decrepitude 2 coming up. So this song is a precursor of what the second half of the album is going to bring and really what a lot of Burzum's catalog brings from this point forward. So this was the last album released prior to Varg going to prison, again, for murder and arson. While he was in prison, he recorded two more albums that were strictly ambient projects. Since he's been out, he's released a number of other albums, but they are largely dominated. The first two were mostly metal. But from that point forward, the albums are largely dominated by ambient music and folk music. So it is a very, very different Burzum that exists now. A lot of the lo-fi production is gone from in favor of more traditional production. A lot less screaming in the vocals in favor of clean singing and spoken word. So it's a different world from this point forward. And you can almost take Decrepitude 1 as a little bit of the turning point because you get a little bit of ambient atmosphere in the beginning. What were your thoughts, sir?
So I don't dislike this song, but it is my least favorite song on the album.
I think it's my least favorite as well.
It does start to introduce kind of the soundscape idea that so you're getting now into some organic and other non-musical instrument sound emerging early in it. This is the most kind of muddy, unstructured. And don't get me wrong, I don't mind unstructured. Remember, big Captain Beefheart fan, although I guess there's a very strange structure to Beefheart ultimately, but it didn't hang together as well to me as the first three songs on the album did. It was interesting to kind of see the introduction of some different auditory elements to it, but it just didn't fully kind of deliver to me. So it was okay, but I felt really good about the first three songs, and this one was the first one that I was kind of like, I can take this one or leave it.
Fair enough. It's probably my least favorite song on the album as well. Now, moving along, we have a short little toe tapper that goes by the name of Circumambulation of the Transcendental Columns of Singularity, which clocks in at a lean 25 minutes and 11 seconds. What's interesting about this is you would think a track with that length would probably be the closer, but it's not. And to me, that was always an interesting choice. To make something that's not just the longest track, but the longest track by a significant margin, be the second to last track on the album. Because you have to remember at the time when this came out, there's still a lot of people buying cassettes, listening to this on vinyl in a non-ironic hipster sort of way, like because it came out on vinyl and that's how they bought it. So, like, this is an interesting choice for me structurally for the album. I'm not saying good or bad, just it's something that always kind of caught my attention. Another thing that stands out about this song, which is an ambient track, you hear more of the synth melodies that have existed in all of the tracks up until this point. One of the things that's been interesting about them is, first off, the other black metal bands weren't really doing this at the time, even though this would become a staple of black metal in large part because of this. But if going back to the first track, Burzum or Dunkelheit, as most people know the song, as washed out and droning as that's and distant and cold as the production on that song is, there's a simple synth melody that cuts through all of that. Even though it's not buried in the mix, but it's not sitting on top of the mix. It is behind the guitars, clearly, when you listen to it. But it still manages to cut through it. And in all of the tracks, there is a strong sense of melody that comes through these songs, in part because of these synth flourishes. That is 100% brought to the forefront in this. One of the things that's interesting with this song, though, is this is the first time on the album you get actual real audible bass that's high up in the mix, which I thought was interesting to save that for the ambient track. What are your thoughts, sir?
So referring to my notes, first note is officially confused. Because there was a vibe going on this album up to this point. And while Deceptitude 1 started to open the door to more of an ambient framework, it still carried a little bit more of the industrial dark kind of grunge into it. And this is, you know, this is pretty darn close to Brian Eno in terms of what you're getting. It's a really good ambient track. I really enjoy ambient music. I think this is a very, very good ambient track. I was thrown, as I kind of came into this, I go, okay, so this is about six songs, but the album's over an hour. And so they must all kind of clock in at a certain size. And then most of the other songs were coming in at 7 or 8 minutes. And I'm like, so how are we going to get to an hour? And I'm like, oh, this is how we get to an hour, because there's 25 minutes of this. And it's good. And I think it's a really well-done ambient track. It is distinctly different than everything that's preceded it and the one track that follows it. So it sits out differently, but it's a really good piece of music. So I enjoyed it. It kind of ripples out as it kind of continues to play, as a lot of the ambient stuff does. You get that kind of 80s synth vibe in some of it as well. But a really, really good piece of ambient music.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. And if you do like his ambient stuff, a lot of the back half of the catalog is ambient, or ambient with folk tracks mixed in. There's a distinct move away from metal as the catalog rolls on from this point.
Yeah, super interesting mix of styles there. But well executed, like I said, it just kind of caught me a little off guard, because it is distinctly different than everything that's happened before on this album.
Yeah, and I personally really enjoy it, and this influenced a lot of metal bands to start including more atmospheric elements into their sound, including more synthesizers into their sound, which is great. There are a number of people, though, who don't like the later Burzum stuff as much because there is less metal. Personally, in my opinion, it makes the metal tracks on those albums that much more impactful. When you get an album that's largely ambient folk music, the handful of metal songs on there, they don't blend together. They really stand out. They really have a lot more of a punch to them, but that's just my personal opinion on it. So that brings us to the final song, Decrepitude 2. I did promise there was going to be the sequel. I like this one significantly more. It brings that sort of organic field recording that you heard a few seconds of in part one, makes that a focal point in this. One of the things that this track does that I 100% stole, in a presentation of an album, not so much in a song, but there is very, very faint guitar droning in the background that throughout the course of the track gets louder and louder until it overcomes all of the other sounds in the track by the end of it. That actually was one of the things that inspired me when I was working with a black metal band and I was putting on my first album with them, when we were sending out copies of it for review or for people to listen to potentially stock in their stores. I was aware that people got, you know, hundreds of CDs, and for bigger stores, probably thousands of CDs. They don't get a lot of black metal, at least at that time. A lot of people didn't even know what black metal was, particularly in the U.S. So I needed something that was going to help us stand out. So I thought back to this song and how the guitars just get louder and louder. And what I did was I mixed the press copies of it, where the first song was very low. The second song got a little bit louder. The third song a little bit louder. This was back in the days of physical CDs that we were sending out people. So they would have to constantly get up and turn down the volume, because they turned it up so loud because the first track was really low to hear it. as each track got louder, they would have to constantly engage with the album, which would force them to look at it, to read the track listing, and just interact with it in some way. And a lot of people told me afterwards when they figured out what we'd done that that was actually a big part of getting them to order CDs or to pay more attention to the album. So that is in large part inspired by this. What are your thoughts, sir?
So I like Deceptitude 2 significantly better than Deceptitude 1. It also, just like Deceptitude 1, starts off with some soundscape kind of organic, much more pronounced than Deceptitude 1. Introduces piano to good effect. Cleaner, and this was kind of part of the reason I liked it better, a little bit kind of cleaner and structured than Deceptitude 1. Towards the tail end of it, it starts to kind of muddy back up, similar to Deceptitude 1. I did really, though, at the very, very tail end, as he brings it home, it was a really nice ending. I actually really enjoyed how this song kind of basically rounds out at the very end. So, liked it significantly. I enjoyed this song quite a bit. Very interesting to kind of have, you know, these bookending, the very long-named ambient track. I thought it was a good song. I do also agree with you that, you know, it kind of felt like its predecessor might have been the natural conclusion to the album. But it was still, I enjoyed it, particularly the front half of the song. There's a little bit towards the middle of the second half that it gets back to Deceptitude 1, but then finishes nicely. So I like the song.
Excellent. So overall, what was your take on this?
So new territory for me. This is not a genre that I've spent a lot of time with. I did enjoy it. I was, again, you know, kind of thrown with a really well-constructed, good ambient track amongst a bunch of other songs that are of a different ilk. But I did, this was, you know, as we go through the Prisoner Exchange, at some point in time, one of us is going to throw out an album to the other that's like, yeah, I didn't like this one much at all. And I had some concern as I went into this one where that this might be the one. And I was certainly going to be straight with you if I'm like, eh, this didn't do it for me. But I did. I appreciate the opportunity to hear it because this is not something I would have come across any other way. I enjoyed it. It's really only one track that I'm just mildly indifferent to. But it's a good album. And if folks haven't had a chance to kind of hear it, they should do that and also check out other parts of his catalog.
Absolutely. But, you know, maybe not so much his political views and things like that.
Probably not.
Yeah. real quick, though, before we leave, one thing of note. For anyone going on YouTube, the band title track, Burzum, which you'll usually find under the German title Dunkelheit, as I mentioned, had a music video. And that music video was shown on VH1. And what I can only imagine was someone's last day of work because they were fired. But you can find uploads of the VH1 screening of the video with the VH1 logo in the corner and stuff. Worth watching, just for that.
So if you can come across that on YouTube and shoot me a link, I'll be sure to include that in the blog post.
Oh, I will, yeah.
Excellent. Good. Nope. I will continue to officially declare this is fun. We kept the Beach Boys callbacks to a minimum this episode, so that was unique.
Wait on the next one.
Yep, there'll be opportunity. Yeah, and of course we will, you know, want to stay true to the theme. Now Mike's introduced, you know, you need to separate the artist from the art. As we come to the next artist, it'll be the Bonzo Dog Duda Band, who's kind of one of the core masterminds of the Bonzo Dog Duda Band is Neil Innes. And Neil takes, you know, much like Burzum, a very strident position that, you know, Elton John's a little bit full of himself. So there's that.
Obviously, there are dark times ahead, more so for Kelly's recommendations than mine.
Clearly.
I hope everybody enjoyed this. I hope you give the album a chance and that you can separate the art from the artist, because you probably already listen to bands who I've done things, said things that you don't agree with. So it's important to kind of keep perspective. Now it's different, like I said, if they bring that into their music, but otherwise separate the product from one of the people behind creating. So I hope you guys give this album a chance. You give all the albums a chance we've listened to. Unfortunately, there was nothing on here I could throw Hillbilly in front of or compare to Achy Breaky Heart, but I'm sure it's going to come.
Yeah, and I think the whole separate the art from the artist should also be considered for Squat Cobbler as well. So do that too, folks. And thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.